I am Plato on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's a new book out that's just a great read, Our Scandalous Senate. It looks at the recent news surrounding the Senate and Senators Pamela Wallin, Mike Duffy, Patrick Brazeau, and Mac Harb, among others. It looks at the institution itself, whether it's relevant, and what its future will be. Its author, J. Patrick Boyer, joins me now. He's eminently qualified to talk about all this, what with the fact he's a constitutional lawyer, a political science professor, and a former member of parliament. The book is a terrific primer on the Senate and its origins and how it's managed to get off the rails, if you will, in the life of this country. Should the Senate be abolished? Can it be reformed? Or is it, as the author entitles a chapter in this book, a relic lost in orbit? I'll ask those questions and more of Patrick Boyer, who was first elected to the House of Commons in 1984 as a progressive conservative MP in the riding of Etobicoke Lakeshore. He was re-elected in 1988 and was defeated in 1993 as well as in 2008. He is a sought-after media commentator and has taught at a number of universities. He's also written a great number of books, listing all of them, would take up the balance of this interview. The website for more is at patrickboyer.wordpress.com, and his Twitter handle is at jpatrickboyer. This book is published by Dundurn. Please welcome to the Plato Online program, Patrick Boyer. Mr. Boyer, good morning.
Joseph, great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So, as I told you before we started, that this is a great précis of the expenses scandal of the last year or two. It seems like you were writing right up to the spring. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And I had a dilemma, Joseph, because I wanted this book to be as thorough in integrating all the different breaking news items of this current Senate expense scandal, which began back in June of 2012 and is still going and will continue through this coming year and next year into the federal general election. I wanted to be as current with that, so I'm keeping up to the last minute to get the just as I was sending it off to the to Dundurn and go to the printers, that day the RCMP laid criminal charges against former Senator Mac Harb and suspended Senator Patrick Brazeau. So I managed to tuck that in, but other developments continue. But I guess the other side of this coin was that I also wanted to get this book out while this issue continues to really upset Canadians, because it's high time that citizens across the country learn the historic facts about our appointed upper house, the senior-most legislative body in a contemporary democratic society where all of its members are, of course, appointed by one person. They're there until age 75. They're well paid for doing relatively little work, and they are largely sustained by myths or fictions, such as this notion of providing sober second thought to the work of the democratically elected House of Commons. So that was why I was trying to get the current Senate scandal well documented in this book, as you've referred to it, Joseph. While at the same time using this to open a window for all Canadians onto the much larger national political scandal, which is the continuing existence of this colonial relic itself.
Hey, we'll talk about the Senate, what it was meant to do, and what its future will be. But let's stick to current affairs for just a sec. In terms of the drama surrounding Duffy, Wallin, and Brazeau, that story hasn't ended yet. Could it end up with criminal charges for all three or either of the three?
Well, at the moment, just to give a current status report, charges have been laid against Mac Harb and Patrick Brazeau just last week in an Ottawa court in judges' chambers. The Crown, lawyers for the Crown and the lawyers for former Senator Mac Harb appeared to have a preliminary hearing as to possible outcomes in the case. So that trial will be proceeding, as will the case with Patrick Brazeau. As of today, yeah, though, the Mounties continue their investigation, which we know reaches far and wide, and the only concrete announcement they've made is that they will not be pressing charges against Prime Minister Harper's former chief of staff, Nigel Wright.
Now, Brazos, whatever charges are against Brazo, are they... I know that he's got a number of personal problems.
Well, last week in Gatineau Court, Patrick Brazo appeared to set a for the setting of a trial date on one of those cases, and then going back to domestic issues.
I see.
And on the second one, the party that had complained, which gave rise to some charges, appeared and asked that the charges be withdrawn, dropped. So I think, you know, that what's happening here is that the personal difficulties of a senator have been brought in to the picture of the larger Senate scandal, and I think it's unfortunate. I think that in many respects, Senator Patrick Brazo has been given the shortest end of the dirtiest stick in Ottawa. But I get into that story in detail in our scandalous Senate.
But he hasn't been charged in terms of his expenses, has he?
He has been charged in terms of the claims that he was making for the out-of-town senator housing allowance. So, both he and Mac Harb have been charged, and certainly Patrick Brazo, when speaking in his own defense in the Senate last October and November, when he, along with Pamela Wallin and Mike Duffy, were suspended by their fellow senators, argued the case that the Senate of Canada is the place where due process comes to die. He pointed out that he had actually received a green light clearance from the Parliamentary Budget Office to do what he was doing. I have seen the wording of a memo called the Green Light Memo, where he inquired about applying for the months that he was in Ottawa for the Senate, and he was told by the Senate Budget Office, no, if you have an apartment in Gatineau, just put it in, the cost of that, for the full 12 months a year up to the $880 limit per month. So that's what he did. And that was the grounds on which he was being thereafter charged, and also being suspended, charged by the Mounties and suspended by the Senate. So there's a lot of hearing and evidence that still has to take place. And in some respects, I think a lot of Canadians look at this upper chamber of Parliament, whose members proclaim to the nation that they are the resident source of sober second thought, and have to look at what Senator Hugh Siegel himself said of the process, that it was operating like the Star Chamber in England, which was basically a judicial process where nobody knew what you were being charged for, you never heard all the evidence, you were convicted in secret, and your execution was done, you know, out of sight. I mean, it was, I think, a bit of an overreaching by Senator Siegel to use that metaphor. But certainly it was right to say that the Senate once again has shown its ability to improvise solutions, to take shortcuts, to pretend it's doing something that's on the up and up, when in fact it's basically just covering itself and hoping the issue will fade away and long enough that it can get back into the only safe place where the Senate of Canada exists, which is in the twilight, where people forget that it's there, and it can lumber on from decade to decade. A very costly institution that's providing little value to Canadians in exchange.
Now, the Senate was based on the House of Lords in Britain. It seems to be working there. I mean, could it work here, the Senate?
Well, the people in Victoria and British Columbia did not think so when they got rid of the upper house, when the two colonies combined to enter Confederation as one province. I'm speaking here in Ontario. We actually had an elected upper house between 1840 and 1867, and the political leaders in this province realized there was no point having a second body to do the same job twice, so the upper house in Ontario was jettisoned when we went into Confederation. Manitoba got rid of its upper house. Nova Scotia did too. So did New Brunswick. So did PEI. Newfoundland does not have an upper house, although once it did. And Quebec was the last of the provinces to abolish its upper house, which it did in 1968. So all of these provinces have got rid of the upper house of the Westminster model, and we're only stuck with this colonial relic in Ottawa. And I got to say that if somebody came along today in 2014 and proposed that we should have a second legislative chamber that would be making the laws of our nation, and that the members of that chamber would be appointed by one person, and that they would be paid well for doing little work, and that they actually had no clearly defined accountability as to who they were answerable to, who they in fact represented, people would laugh that idea right out of existence. It would be preposterous to propose today that we should have something like the present-day Senate of Canada. And yet, simply because it is there, so many people tug their forelock and nod and bow and curtsy and defer to this institution simply because it has been there for so long. It's like a big rock in the middle of the highway that people have been driving around for so long, they kind of think it's natural. Well, it's not natural. It's an aberration for a democratic 21st century country, as I document in many ways in our scandalous Senate.
Now, it can't, in your mind, it can't be reformed. It wouldn't be improved, say, if it were elected?
Well, first on, can it be reformed? Within the decade after the initial Confederation in 1867, talk was already underway, Joseph, about changing and reforming the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 1800s, the Liberal Party of Canada adopted as a plank of its platform Senate reform. But nothing happened from that. Despite many efforts, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau tried heroically to change the Senate into the House of the Confederation. Didn't happen. Prime Minister Mulroney in the Charlottetown Accord, working with all the premiers, negotiated having a Triple E Senate that would be effective, equal, and elected. Didn't happen. So at the end of 140 years, the only reform that has been made in the Senate was done by Prime Minister Lester Pearson for the Liberal government in the mid-1960s when he capped the retirement age for senators at age 75, which was a pretty good thing because there were an awful lot of jokes around about the senators who were docile and falling asleep in the chamber. And twice under the old regime, Canada held the world record for the oldest parliamentarian on the planet. Once we had a senator who was 102, another time a senator who was 103. Well, it's great to be a legislator who gets in the Guinness Book of Records, but it should be for your legislative prowess, not your longevity.
There's another Canadian who made the Guinness Book of Records in terms of the guy from Saskatchewan, I think, Charles MacDonald.
Oh, well, now there's a great case.
Yeah.
That's in the book, and thank you for mentioning that, Joseph, because I think it will entertain Canadians, but it will also illuminate just the charade that goes around this appointed upper house. And this goes back to a time when the Liberals were very strong in Saskatchewan, and up in Prince Albert, one of the local organizers wanted very much to get the Liberal nomination because he knew if he got the nomination he would be elected to the Commons. So he persuaded four other contenders not to run for the nomination because if they didn't, he would get elected. He spoke with all of them separately. He would get elected, and then in the House of Commons he would see that when the time came they would get appointed to the Senate. So they all stepped aside for him, and he was elected, but it took quite a while before anything really happened. And then when the Senate appointment came open, he took it for himself. And so there was the result that through promising as many people in the country hearing what a fine job it is to be a senator want the position, fine in the sense of good pay, excellent security, very little work. Sometimes you don't even have to show up and nobody worries about it. Mm-hmm. In his case, he managed to get the Senate seat for himself. A long story of how people have been duped to and acquiesce to a lot of things in Canadian public life on the promise of a Senate seat that never materializes for them.
Yeah. And then did McDonald die before he got into the Senate?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. What this book also does is it tells us of the people who have served the Senate, other than Duffy, Wallen, and Brezzo. A lot of people that you've gotten to know over the years from your time when you were up on the Hill, people like David Braley and Senator Oliver, Senator Siegel, they have left the Senate in over the last year or two. And I get a sense from reading the sketches on them that you also share the melancholy that they have about how Ottawa is.
Well, Joseph, that's true. And there is a chapter in the book called The Hollowing Out of the Senate. And it talks about a number of senators in the past year and a half who have retired early. In a few cases, really fine people who just didn't like any longer the stench of the place that they were working and the public disregard for them as senators because, the thing with the celebrity senators that Prime Minister Harper appointed, especially Mike Duffy and Pamela Wallen and Patrick Brizzo, celebrities bring with them a spotlight. They're, mm-hmm. they're in the eye of the media, and so all of a sudden practices that have been going on and tolerated and even encouraged for decades in the Senate, lax business administration, easy accounting, paying for things even where there wasn't documentation to support them, all these practices suddenly came into the sharper light of media scrutiny, and through that to the Canadian people learning of this since the past 2 years now, people have been outraged at the things that are being revealed about the Senate. Well, that's what has caused people, as you rightly asked, Joseph, good people, to leave the Senate early. They just don't want to stick around on board a ship that they can see is sinking below the waterline. But there are also other senators, and I discuss them in the book, who initially seemed to get by when the Internal Economy Committee of the Senate, made up of senators running the place in a very hands-on manner, gave them a pass on their accounts, said, oh yeah, we've looked at it, and they had in-camera sessions, asked a few questions, said, no, everything's fine. But when it came to light that the Auditor General of Canada was going to be reviewing all senators' expenses, more senators took early retirement. Mm-hmm. And I identify a number of them in the book because, as I am speaking to you now, I can say with certainty that when the Auditor General completes drilling down into the expense records of all of the senators, 105 senators, more will come to light. I grew up in a small town as a boy. I used to lift up rocks and watch things that were crawling around under there. Well, that's what the Auditor General is doing on Parliament Hill. He's lifting up the lid that has been kept on Senate expenses, and I think that Canadian citizens are going to see there's a lot more crawling around that we would wish wasn't the case. But I do want to make one point in answering your question, Joseph, and that is my complaint is not with any of the individual senators. There are very fine Canadians who are members of the Canadian Senate. Almost every one of them is a fascinating person that any one of us would be enriched by sitting down and talking with and listening to their life story and all that they have contributed to the country in so many dimensions. My issue is with the continuing existence of this institution itself. And I find it's actually a sad thing that good people have to try and do the work that they are doing, those that care about doing good work, through the muted channels of a dysfunctional institution whose moving parts do not connect with any of the effective operations of government and parliament in Canada.
What do you make of how the media has covered this? I know there's a lot of, I guess, schadenfreude over covering, say, Duffy and Wallen from the media, because there are a lot of people in the media that are upset that they went over to the other side. But in terms of say, the coverage that we've seen, the media has done a pretty good job. I guess the one thing that I found quite disturbing in reading your book was during the investigation of the RCMP, that the stuff that got leaked to the press, in terms of just the notes from the investigation, reports from officers, even before charges were considered or laid.
Yes, I think the media has been all over this, and rightly so. I say in the book that they would not, the interest of the Parliamentary Press Gallery would not have been as acute if the only expense claim issue was that of Senator Mac Harb, because although I knew Mac from the days we were both in the House of Commons together before Jean Chrétien appointed him to the upper house, it's accurate to say that he was not a household name in our country.
Uh-huh.
However, certainly Pamela Wallen and Mike Duffy were national stars, celebrities, showcasing many events, charity as well as news gathering and news reporting. So they were very prominent, and it was their celebrity status that gave an added incentive to the news media to cover the story, because it had breaking news written all over it. And so that, I think, is what accelerated the interest and kept it going. Now, what happens then is that there are people around Ottawa, a lot of insiders, who've learned things that normally they wouldn't talk about or have a chance to talk about. But there was one person who leaked to Robert Fife, a preeminent broadcaster, a journalist, originally from Chapleau in Northern Ontario, and Bob Fife in Ottawa is long had an interest in corruption in government and wrote a book on this subject that I used to use in the university courses that I taught. And so when he got this leaked story to him about the payment by Nigel Wright, chief of staff to the prime minister, who trying to make a bad problem disappear by paying Mike Duffy's $90,000 expenses out of his own bank account, Robert Fife broadcast that, and that then catapulted the story into yet another high level, because it now involved the Prime Minister's office. So step by step, and I document them all in our Scandalous Senate, how this kind of unceasing chain of events led inexorably to where we are today. The role of the media was indispensable, but just as Robert Fife refused to tell the RCMP about his source on the grounds that he never gives mm-hmm. interviews about his journalism work, and a lot of us would defend his position, saying it is not the job of journalists to do the work of the police, that proposition got stood on its head as this process continued, because the Mounties, when wanting to get more documents, would file applications with the court in Ottawa, setting out basically what they had reason to believe at that time in order to justify the court giving them the right to subpoena additional documents, letters, emails, bank accounts, and so forth. The result of that was that the Canadian public, getting access to these court records because the media was reporting everything that the Maoris were saying, was basically getting updated reports on a police investigation in progress. Normally, the police are very tight-lipped about who they're investigating and what charges might be. So we ended up in this strange current scandal, so suited to the Senate because it itself is so strange in the Canadian political landscape, that the police were actually doing the work of the journalists, providing this kind of information. So it's a very mixed up story. I sort out the elements of it in the book, but I can certainly say that were we not living in a free and democratic society where freedom of the press is treasured and essential, so much of this story would not be known, if any of it.
Now, well, we're heading into an election year. Do you think after all of it, the Senate will still be around?
Well, it depends on what happens between now and next year's election, Joseph. My hope would be that in October of 2015, when each of us goes to our polling station and is handed a ballot to vote for our representative in the Commons, we would also be handed a second ballot as part of a Canada-wide referendum on the Senate, in which we were asked, do you favor abolition of the Senate of Canada? Yes, no. And I do believe that Canadian citizens at this juncture in our political evolution certainly have a right and a duty to give a very clear verdict on the future of the Senate and whether we shouldn't just give it its place in history and bring the curtain down once and for all on this relic institution. You know, we do have the sovereign in this country, the crown, the monarch, but we also have a second sovereign, and that is the people. Nobody gets into office to exercise the powers of the crown as ministers of the crown or so on unless and until they are first elected by the sovereign people. So we have this notion of dual sovereignty, and I am saying that in next year, in 2015, the sovereign people of Canada ought to send a very clear message to Canadian legislators in the provincial assemblies and in Ottawa that the time has come to pass the simple resolutions that would repeal the constitutional provisions that created the Senate so that once and for all it can vanish from the scene.
And inside the cover of your book here, you've got a list of all these books that you've written heretofore. It's a long list, as I said. You're a prolific author. What's next for you? You're working on another book now?
Well, I am, but I should say, you know, you're referring to, I think it's 20 or so books that are listed inside this one, this book that's published by Dunder. And Joseph, every one of those earlier books had a subtitle. This book, Our Scandalous Senate, is the first book that I've ever been able to write where I did not need a subtitle to explain it. Canadians get it right from the first image. Yes, I am working on a book that Dundurn will be publishing next spring. It's called The Big Blue Machine, and that one, I guess, will have a subtitle. It's How Tory Campaigns Transformed Canadian Public Affairs.
Well, we'll look forward to that one, but till then, I hope a lot of people pick this book up because, it's, as I said, it's very readable. It provides a lot of history and information, as well as gives us a lot of questions that we ought to think about as an electorate. Continued good luck with this book. It's been a pleasure chatting with you today, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much, Joseph, and I'm certain that listeners to your very important program, The Commentary, will take that message from you to heart because, yes, this is a matter, ultimately, that we have to come to terms with as citizens of this country and get it right once and for all. Thank you very much for having me on, Joseph.
You're very welcome. The Twitter handle is at jpatrickboyer. The website, patrickboyer.wordpress.com. The book is called Our Scandalous Senate. It's from Dundurn. Its author, J. Patrick Boyer, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunton.